Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Toby Pearl, teacher, lawyer, author. And we're talking about her book, Terror to the Wicked, America's First Trial by Jury That Ended a War and Helped to Form a Nation. Toby, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you for having me.
This is such an unusual, interesting story. And it's also one of those pieces of history I'm really surprised I never learned about in school, as they say. How did you come to the story?
Yeah, I had the same reaction when I came across these events. And I was surprised growing up in New England. I'd never heard about them before. And I came across the true events, this murder, manhunt, and jury trial, actually doing a little genealogical family research. My husband, who's also an author, the novelist Matthew Pearl, actually gave me a membership to NEHG, New England Historic Genealogical Society, NEHGS, and it was a holiday gift to go, and I had been very interested in studying my family history. We had just welcomed our third child, and I was curious about kind of our relatives and ancestors. And in doing this research at this kind of world-class research institution right in our backyard at Boston, I came across the story of America's first significant jury trial. And as someone who once practiced law and once sat as a juror on a jury trial, I was immediately engrossed to kind of tease out the details of this jury trial and under such compelling circumstances. And I was so curious why this hadn't been included in our history books. And I was eager to kind of take a stab at writing up this nonfiction book myself.
Now, one of the great things about this book is you really see this story from two cultures' points of view, the British Americans, the colonialists who live here, and the Native Americans. And I think you did a good job of representing Native American points of view in this. And it's a complicated story. So for the benefit of the audience, I want to back up and talk about New England. So it's southeastern New England, mostly, that we're talking about this time. What Native American peoples lived in this area at the time? We're talking about the mid-1600s.
Sure. The jury trial took place in 1638. The trial was held in Plymouth Colony, and the murder, it was a murder trial. The murder took place in this kind of land in between Plymouth Colony and what is now Providence, Rhode Island. So you're exactly right. When I sat down to start writing this, when I first looked at the events, what was available to me from archival research identified a lot of the colonists, men who had written letters and journal articles, but I could quickly see that the players in these events involved American Indians, involved settlers, involved women, involved children, and I wanted to do everything I could to bring each of those people to create kind of a full global portrait. And I knew I was going to have to work harder to make sure every American Indian voice was heard and represented in the book to the best of my ability. And it was tricky with archival research where the archives kind of fall short in that department. And I did exhaustive research and I focused on the tribes that were directly involved in these events, which were the Narragansett, the Wampanoag, and then the murder victim was Nipmuc. And at the time, the Nipmuc were allied with the Narragansett. And these events unfolded against the backdrop of the Pequot War, which was fought between 1636 and 1638, and largely involved Mass Bay colonists, so present-day Boston, waging war against the Pequot. And you can think of present-day Connecticut. And it's a little tricky to talk about kind of specific regions that each group of American Indians or bands of tribes represented and kind of the territories that were engaged with. But I tried to focus as much as I could on every single person, regardless if it was a man, a woman, a child, an American Indian, doing full justice to that human being.
Now, you talked about the Pequot War, and you write in your book that it changed everything, and it's really fascinating as you write. The British settlers who landed in Massachusetts and started a colony here, they originally had a fairly positive relationship with the Native American people that were here, but it went south pretty quickly. And I love the fact that you discussed this. A lot of it had to do with old sort of different concepts about property. What did it mean to own land in New England? And that created a huge conflict between Native Americans and settlers.
That's exactly right. You had a couple of things coming to fruition at once. And you had, and this might be more detail than we need, but you had people leaving England at a time when communal property in England had been diminished and seized, and coming to what is called present-day New England, looking for property rights, looking to settle in a place after leaving and facing tyranny in England, and kind of this sense of very much wanting to purchase land and this professed intention of purchasing it fairly. And you see these terrible cultural collisions. To be charitable, describe it as kind of unwitting collisions. And then you also see unscrupulous actions. And by the time you have the Pequot War unfolding in 1636, you see genocide. You see concerted efforts to displace, kill the Pequot. And then in 1638, you see the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade and an effort to take Pequot people and create this triangle of slave trade and displace the Pequot through the slave trade. So it's a terrible moment in our history. And I really wanted to walk very carefully to do everything I could to shine a light on this history. Growing up around Boston, mm-hmm. I hadn't really heard of the Pequot War, I'm embarrassed to say.
I hadn't heard it until I read it in your book.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, I've met many people who've said exactly the same thing. And there's,
well, so you know, you hear about King Philip's War, but you never hear about the Pequot War.
That's right. And if you think of the 17th century in New England, which we actually think about quite a bit because kind of our origin narrative in America, flawed as it might be, really stems the heart of it out of the 17th century. And if you think of the 17th century in New England and you kind of think of the Mayflower and the first Thanksgiving, and then by the end of the 17th century, you can think about King Philip's War. But it's the beginning of the 17th century where you have the Pequot War. And those two wars, the book and the 17th century, really tell a very complicated and dark tale about that first century of our history that predates the Revolution. But it's very much about the origins of our country. And I think sometimes when we focus so much on Thanksgiving and those early years after the Mayflower, I think it's troubling to incorporate discussions about the Pequot War, but it is very much part of our history.
It's interesting. And just to review for the listening audience,
sure.
Native Americans didn't have a sense of private property. I mean, so the British settlers are saying, like, here, we'll sign over this contract and we're going to buy all this land. And the Native Americans are going, yeah, whatever, sure. But that means I can still hunt and fish and walk through it, which seems reasonable. But as you explained before, from these people coming from the political situation in Britain, they were going to have none of that. So the whole attitude towards Native Americans switched from these people who are helping us out because we're starving, which is what happened in the first year of the Plymouth colony, to these are savages. And so there's this story that you tell starts at a really tense time between Native Americans and British settlers.
That's right. 1638 really is the culmination of all of these trends. It's by 1638, as you've pointed out, you've had many settlers purchasing land, whether fairly or unfairly, with written deeds. We can go and see these deeds. They're still in existence today at local archives. And have gone to great lengths to write up deeds for purchase and sale of property. And yet you have American Indians in the area who hunt and migrate and use the land for different purposes at different times of the year. And it's a complete kind of collision course of cultures and leading to explosive tensions. The Pequot War is unfolding. And then you also have, by 1638, a large percentage of Plymouth Colony's population, about 17%, were made up of indentured servants. And in fact, the accused murderer in the story was an indentured servant.
Let's talk about him now, okay? Let's talk about Arthur Peach and his rapier. He's sort of, he's not an exactly likable character from the get-go. he's sort of a weird guy. He's gotten a woman pregnant. He decides to just leave where the Carswell estate in Mansfield, where he's an indentured servant, and he leaves with three other people. Why does he leave with three other people?
That's right. You've got the young Arthur Peach. He's a former battle-tested soldier out of the Pequot War. He's originally from Ireland, and he decides to leave Edward Winslow, the former governor of Plymouth Colony. He decides to leave the Winslow estate and escape during the night and flee Plymouth Colony. And this was something at the time that indentured servants were not allowed to do. So indentured servants would sign contracts to work for upwards of 7 years in exchange for land and their freedom. What happened by 1638, a lot of these promised land grants were evaporating. Conditions for these, largely men, some women, but mostly young men, were poor. If there were problems with their behavior, cursing, or, you know, whatever social infractions, their indenturitude could be extended beyond 7 years. And many people, but Arthur Peach among them, found the situation frustrating, and he decided to leave. And
well, speeding up this narrative, because I want to make sure we talk about a lot of stuff. You know, people got to realize back in those days, it's not like there's a lot of roads that you could walk on. So they're sort of bushwhacking through the forest there, from, you know, Marshfield going west. And they don't really know what they're doing. They don't seem to be really great at like finding food, and so they're just sort of camped out in the middle of nowhere, it seems. And Arthur Peach has got this rapier with him, and at one point, and this is the key person here, and I'm not going to pronounce his name correctly, Penawanayanki.
That's very, I've been pronouncing it Penawanayanquis, who was the Nipmuc trader. And you're right, these indentured servants find themselves kind of lost, disoriented, with really no provisions, kind of perhaps purposefully in the middle of nowhere in terms of other settlements nearby. They don't want to be discovered. They want to kind of be able to escape the work commitments of Plymouth Colony. And they're heading toward present-day New York. They're heading far south, but they've made their way only approaching Providence, Rhode Island. So from the outskirts of Plymouth, they have not gone very far. So they're kind of in a miserable situation at the height of summer. I've walked through those woods myself at the same time of year with my dog, and we've both left the woods kind of exhausted, desperate for water. It gets very hot. Mosquitoes are awful.
So here's this Nipmuc trader,
yep.
Penawanayanki. He passes them heading east. He's going to the Aptucket Trading Post, which is it's sort of where near the Cape Cod Canal is right now.
Correct, the Aptucket Trading Post, that's right.
And so he's walking there, and he's going to trade in some pelts and stuff like that. And it seems that Arthur Peach right then and there says, well, he's going to be coming back. I'm going to murder him and take what he has.
That's right. And it, even as you say that now, I still get a chill.
It's very bizarre.
Yes. And to have this recorded in these archival documents, you know, these events are almost 400 years old. And here you have kind of this classic, we study this in law school. It's kind of a classic lying in wait, kind of first degree murder scenario. He is planning to kill Panayiotis when he comes back along that path, because he may well have suspected correctly that Panayiotis, the traitor, would be coming back along the path, not with a beaver pelt, but with a large satchel filled with wampum, the currency of the day, which would have been salvation for Arthur Peach in his desperate situation.
And sure enough, we're gonna sort of give you the short version of the narrative here.
Sure.
Panayiotis does come back with the wampum, and he is jumped by these four guys, especially by Arthur Peach, who does stab him with his rapier and leaves him for dead in the swamp. And they take off further west. And then just let's follow them for a bit. They end up having some weird adventures on the way. They end up bumping into William Blackstone, who you describe as a mysterious hermit. Now, I'm in here in Worcester. We're at the north end of the Blackstone National Corridor. And we have the Blackstone River running right here. William Blackstone, who this whole thing is named after, he was sort of an eccentric guy at that point. He's just living in the middle of nowhere by himself.
That's correct. Yeah, he left present-day Boston, Mass Bay Colony, as it began to become populated, and he struck out on his own. He found the most isolated spot he could in the woods south, and he had America's first library. And he kind of, it was a survival situation. He kind of struck out in the wilderness and survived in this kind of hand-to-mouth existence with his library and nothing more. He was not a nice person. He, it's hard to even put this into words, because it's just, we talk about these dark moments in our history, but he had an American Indian woman living in his home against her will. And we know that she was living against her will in his home because she escaped multiple times was branded on her arm to show his possession of this woman. So just these unspeakable horrors. But yeah, I mean, for this lonely path in the woods, for the Peach Gang, as this Arthur Peach's companions became known, they bumped into quite a few.
Including Roger Williams.
Well, right. That was kind of the most striking, one of the many striking moments in the story. Panayiotis, the murder victim, survived long enough to identify his killers. But he identified those killers to none other than Roger Williams, the founder of Providence, Rhode Island. And, you know, interesting quick backstory on Roger Williams. He had interned, back in early 17th century England for... kind of the father of English common law. So Roger Williams had this remarkable legal background himself, and he became very nervous about the prospect of kind of staging one of America's most significant first jury trial. There was a lot, kind of the likelihood of all of these people intersecting on this lonely path in the woods all at once is just unimaginable to me, but somehow it happened.
Now, Peach and the gang...
Yeah.
Stop by Roger Williams' house.
Right.
And they're moving on. They're going south to this weird island in Rhode Island. And Williams sort of suspects something's up. And he has an indigenous boy living in the house called Will.
Right.
And he sends Will to spy on them.
Right. This wasn't apparent. The first 2 years, I would say, that I spent researching and writing this book, the whole thing took about 5 years. It took me a couple of years of intensive research, going over the facts, going through the archival research endlessly, to realize that Will was missing from these events. When you just read the overview, the letters, the journals, you know, there's a reference to a messenger being sent into the woods to follow after these accused murderers. It took me a long time to figure out who that messenger was. And when I realized it was this young child, this boy, a Pequot boy named Will, I you could have knocked me over with a feather. It was the last person I had ever imagined who would have had a hand in apprehending the murderers. And, you know, I have an 11-year-old son. I think about that age group trekking alone through the woods, tracking down these men who had just
murdered someone.
You know, murdered someone. It was unbelievable to me. It was an incredible moment.
Now, Williams does go to try to recover Penawana Yankee, right?
That's correct.
He leaves with two doctors, Doctors Green and Thomas James, I think. And they find him, and he's essentially near death. They give him what medical care they can, but then they have to still truck him back. Was it 10 miles or something like that?
Yeah.
And he dies, and something happens to his body. Do we know today what happens to his body? Just disappears.
Right. And this becomes one of the centerpieces at the murder of the defense. His body was not found. So, as historians have argued, the last time Penawana Yanquist was seen alive by a witness, Roger Williams, you know, on his deathbed as he was, he had been very much alive. So when they did go to prosecute the murderers, that became a defense. Once he passed away, and the doctors, Roger Williams, everyone was without doubt that his injuries had been mortal. There was no way he could have survived. But whether the Narragansett who lived adjacent to Roger Williams had intervened, the Nipmuc and the Narragansett were allies, whether there was a cremation once he passed away. I did a lot of research into kind of that cultural practices of cremation and burial among the Nipmuc, and I was really lucky to have access to a library that focuses just on anthropology and has some wonderful books and resources on the Nipmuc at Harvard. But they're theories. And it's for some reason, that's kind of a mystery that remains. And it certainly was a major issue at trial.
But the big deal is three of the gang are caught, including Peach.
Correct.
One of them, Daniel Cross, escapes to New Hampshire, where he's never brought to justice.
Yeah.
And we don't know what happened to him to this day. He literally got away with murder.
He literally got away with murder. And the fact that he survived, you know, you think about what it would take to walk to New Hampshire with almost no resources. But we know he survived because the folks in New Hampshire loved flouting the extradition request sent by Plymouth Colony. You know, they said in no uncertain terms they were not sending him back down. So, you know, that area, you know, we think of New Hampshire, there's been a long history of kind of going their own way.
Yep.
And they did not send him back, but we do know he made it.
Well, we only have minutes left. I think the amazing thing is there is the decision by Roger Williams and others that Peach needs to be brought on a murder trial by jury.
Right.
And with things that were, I mean, that sort of seems, because so many negative things were happening between Native Americans and European settlers, that's sort of a surprising decision. But it was Roger Williams realizing that if we don't do this, the political outfall of not holding these people accountable for the death of a Native American would be disastrous.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, it was a time of war. The Pequot War was ongoing, and it was a brutal war. And yet you see these leaders of both the American Indian tribes and the settlers all stepping forward and having these very purposeful conversations.
Yep, very serious conversations.
Very serious conversations, including Massasoit Wissamique,
well,
of the Wampanoag.
Don't give that away. But Massasoit's intervention there with Roger Williams took me totally by surprise. You explain what he meant by it, but essentially he wanted to let Peach go. He wanted the other two people to be found guilty. And you're going to need to read the book for that. Where was the trial eventually held?
So eventually it was held, after much discussion, it was held in Plymouth Colony at the Meeting House. So you can go today and see a replica of that Meeting House. It was held, and it was kind of the trial of the century. The letters, the correspondence, the journal entries about this trial all speak to this being a moment of heightened suspense. No one knew which way the jurors were going to find. And indeed, on record, are comments kind of by the rank and file citizens of Plymouth Colony kind of going in both directions about what should be done with these accused murderers. So it was a real nail biter.
And what I want to say for the benefit of the audience is you paint a palpable, you can feel, because the in that building, the trial is held on one floor and the deliberations by the jury are just on the next floor up.
Yeah.
Where there's no place for them to sit, except there's a big cannon. And so you can just hear them sort of walking around deliberating. And it's an amazing event that occurs. This is such an outstanding book as far as portraying all the players in this. And there's a lot of interesting digressions, and we're not going to have time for them. So you're going to have to read the book to learn how Stephen Hopkins was connected with Shakespeare's Tempest.
Right. Yeah, no, it's packed with incredible, just things I could not have believed, but they really did happen. And I'm excited for readers to kind of go on that journey.
This is a really interesting, fascinating history. My guest tonight has been Toby Pearl. She's a teacher, lawyer, author, and we're talking about her book, Terror to the Wicked, America's First Trial by Jury That Ended a War and Helped to Form a Nation. Toby, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Absolute pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.